And welcome to the No Noise Podcast. My name is James Fletcher. I'm here.
Trevin Fiorenwell. Hey
Of
guys, what's
course.
going on? It's great, great, great afternoon here at 90.7 The Capstone. Ugh,
It
it's
is.
been
It's been
it was a
a
tough
long
week for
time.
me. It
It's
was
been
a
a
tough
long
week for
time.
me.
What you we had the holiday weekend since we last spoke.
Yeah.
What'd you do over the weekend?
Just me, turkey, football, and shave and shopping. Making some sales, going to some sales. Black Friday is one of my favorite days of the year.
Yeah, me too.
So.
All right, we'll get into that a little later. But right now, before we get into anything too serious that'll take up too much time, we want to get to Gary Parrish from CBS Sports, lead basketball analyst for college basketball. And he was kind enough, nice enough to grant us an interview. We got 20 minutes of his time, so we're going to go ahead and get to Gary Parrish here. And I hope you guys enjoy. Let's hear from Gary. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a special treat for you on this edition of the No Noise Podcast. We have CBS's Gary Parrish here to talk a little bit about what he's seen in the season so far, a little about his mock draft where he has Herb Jones going to the Boston Celtics, and we might get into these new net ratings if we have time as well. Gary, what's up?
Everything's good, man. You been all right?
I've been great. Things are going well this semester. Looking forward to a great basketball season. So you've gotten to see Duke a lot. You got to see them in their first game of the season when they blew out Kentucky, and of course you were in Maui for that Thanksgiving Maui Invitational. What have you seen from them? What makes this team special?
Three top five picks, four first round picks. I mean, if you wanted to keep it as simple as possible, I've seen them now in four of their seven games. I was there for four of the first six, like you said, Champions Classic, and the three games in Maui. And though they did lose to Gonzaga, in that championship game, it doesn't change anything about them. I mean, they are still the most talented team in the country. If you want to argue they're not the best, that's a reasonable thing to argue because Gonzaga is also obviously terrific. Kansas is obviously terrific. Virginia is obviously terrific. But they are the most talented team. And they're still trying to figure things out. Like, I think one of their issues, to the extent that they have issues, because their issues are much smaller than anybody else's or most everybody else's, how do you handle having three guys who would be an undeniable star on any other team in the country? In R.J. Barrett, Zion Williamson, and Cam Reddish. Through the first six games of the season, R.J. was missing as many shots as Zion was taking. And though I don't know that R.J. doesn't need to be the leading shot getter on Duke, I do believe that the discrepancy can't be as wide as it was. Or at the very least, you got to get Zion more shots. And I thought it was interesting to hear Mike Krzyzewski after the win over Indiana the other night say we put some things in after we got back from Maui to try to get Zion more opportunity. So I'm not trying to compare myself to a Hall of Fame coach, but we're seeing the same thing. Like, if you've got somebody as uniquely gifted as Zion Williamson, he doesn't need to be getting that many fewer shots than one of his teammates, even if his teammates is in contention also for the number one pick in the NBA draft. So simply put, they've got the greatest coach of all time, and they've got, a roster that might allow them to put three players in the top five of an NBA draft, of the same NBA draft. Like, we really might be watching some unprecedented stuff. And so it's a special group, undeniably.
Yeah, and we've got now this team. There's been comparisons to the Fab Five. People have talked about that. You've got LeBron now tweeting about them. They had their own documentary series following the team through the preseason. Is this the most famous team we've ever seen in college basketball? Of course, you had the five Fab Five, but Zion Williamson with more followers than I think any other college basketball player ever. What does that make this team the most famous you've ever seen?
Well, I think that's a good word to use because LeVar Ball actually used this once upon a time while talking about LaMelo Ball. He said, "My son is the most famous high school basketball player in history because of social media." Just more people are aware of people now. I mean, there are people who have television shows or who are models that I've never seen their shows, and I wouldn't know their models except for I follow them on Instagram or Twitter or wherever. And so fame is a good way to put it. I guess if you were going to try to argue against it, the argument would be college basketball is not as big as it used to be because, you know, the players don't stick around very long. And so there's no continuity. There's no familiarity. You know, from one year to the next, you don't know who are going to be the best players in the country. I mean, I know, but like people who just follow college basketball casually don't know. For instance, you know, Tua Tagovailoa was a star after last year's national championship game. And you knew that we were going to get another year of him and then another year of him. But you know, if the, whatever the comp for that would be happened in college basketball, that'd be it. He'd be gone after last season, you know, one and done and out of here. And so, you know, that's a real issue with college basketball is that the coaches are the stars because, you know, Zion and RJ didn't start buzzing with casual college basketball fans really until classic. And then 4 months later, they'll be gone, you know, off to the NBA. So I'll put it this way. Here's what I think they are. If you're trying to put a label on them, they are the most talented freshman reliant team in college basketball history. And I include the Fab Five in that. The Fab Five was tremendous. But people forget this about the Fab Five. All they remember is that they played in back-to-back national championship games and Chris Webber was a monster. They finished, I don't remember what the record was in the Big Ten, maybe like 10-6. They were a sixth seed in the NCAA tournament. I believe that's right. They weren't good throughout the season. I mean, they were good, but they weren't great. Like, this Duke team's going to be great all season. That Michigan Fab Five team, the first one, when they were all freshmen, that team wasn't great. And also, if every one of them would have turned pro after their freshman years, at least two of them wouldn't have been picked. And there's no way three of them would have gone in the top five. Whereas, you know, Duke's four freshman starters are all going to be first-round picks, and three of them are probably going in the top five. And so I do think we're talking about one of the – I think we're talking about the most talented freshman-reliant team in the history of college basketball, and they've got the best chance we've ever seen of a team starting four freshmen to win a national championship because it's never been done before.
Mm-hmm. And you talked about Cam Reddish when you talked about the problems, or you talked about all three of the freshmen and how they aren't used to being the number two or the number three option. And Cam Reddish is kind of the main focus there as he's become a third option after being the first option his whole life. And I think that's one of the main concerns that we've seen as mock drafts come out where people are slotting him a little lower than maybe he was in the high school rankings because people don't have this concern that he might not be able to fit into a role. Do you think he'll be able to fit in and settle down into his role and that his stock will kind of come up a little bit? I know you have him at fourth. I have him at fourth, but some people have started to drop him.
I think sometimes I think mock drafts move people around more than front offices do. If you talk to, you know, general managers and guys who are actually going to be decision makers on draft night, they don't sway on players nearly as much as mock drafts do. It's why, you know, at some point I'm an employee, so you update it when your boss tells you to. But I don't like updating it every 2 weeks because things don't change every 2 weeks. And yet when you're being asked to, in the spirit of getting page views or having some fresh content, a lot of times you end up moving things just for the sake of moving things. And I've always done my best to reject that, but I know not everybody does. And so I don't know that Cam Reddish has really hurt himself this season. I don't know that he's helped himself, but I would say just because you've seen him drop in somebody's mock draft doesn't necessarily mean he's dropped on somebody's big board. But to your point, they are all being asked to do things they've never done before. You know, for Zion, it's play with another great player. With RJ, it's play with another great player. For Cam, it's play with two other great players and maybe be the third option on that team. And for Trey Jones, it's, hey, just run our team. That's all we need you to do. Mm-hmm. And so I think they've done remarkably well, given that it's still November and they're crushing basically everybody except Gonzaga And even though the Auburn game got close at the end, they were never going to lose that game. They were never in real trouble, even though it was a 6-point game, I think, at the final buzzer. So, listen, I think they've all handled it well. It can't be easy to be the star your entire life and then be asked to give up shots, play a different role. But they're blending in pretty well now, and if they're doing it well now, I would assume it only gets better going forward.
Yeah, and I think the issue with Cam Reddish that a lot of people see is that he's not knocking down his threes. That's something that in a new environment, a new role, that's going to take a little time. It'll come back, I think, by the end of the season. He'll be shooting just as well as we saw him in high school. But now let's move forward into the part of
One thing I would say on that, I don't mean to interrupt, but yeah. It's such a small sample size
right.
that – NBA people at this point, the guys like Cam, like that level guy who's been on NBA radars for years, mm-hmm. they've seen him enough now to where they're not worried about a shot. Like, even if he's not making shots, they're not concerned about the shot. When front office people are concerned about shots, it's when there's something like fundamentally wrong
like
with
Markel.
Like Markel Fultz, like Lonzo Ball. That's when they get worried about it. I think this is true. If you go back and look at Bradley Beal, who's one of the great shooters in the world, if you go look at Bradley Beal at the end of, in his 1 year at college, I don't think he shot a great percentage, and yet NBA people were totally unconcerned because they had seen him shoot enough over the years, and they know that the shot, there's nothing wrong with it. They knew he would be a great NBA shooter even if he didn't shoot incredibly well at Florida. And I think for Cam, it'll be similar. I'm not saying Cam's a shooter like Bradley Beal is, but to the extent that he's got a reputation as a shooter, it's been developed over years, and 7 games isn't really going to hurt that.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about you picked Herb Jones from Alabama right here in Tuscaloosa to the Celtics at 25. Of course, the team and the position changes every day with the NBA rankings. But can you talk about Herb Jones, what he did to get into this position, and what you think he needs to do moving forward to raise or keep his stock where it is?
Well, what he did, it's interesting, the NBA, when it comes to prospects, they are way more interested in what they think you can do someday than what you've already done. You're way better off measuring and running and jumping a certain way than you are just being a great basketball player without those things, without the measurements and the athleticism. You know, Dedrick Lawson is a preseason first team All-American in Kansas. He's been terrific so far. He's not in most anybody's first round. He's a great basketball player for college. But he's not an athlete. He's not a jumper. He doesn't play above the rim. People are worried, how will that translate? I say all that to say with Herb, like 6'7", wing, who can run, good athlete, maybe great athlete, got a reputation as somebody who will play hard, who cares about both ends of the court. You know, in this world where everybody's looking for 3-and-D wings, he's got the potential to be that. He's got good size for the position. And this season, I think he's off to a good start because first, NBA people, the first thing they're going to do is identify you as a prospect. Then they want to see you become a player. So he was identified as a prospect very early last season. Clearly not in high school because I think he was a sub-100 guy coming out of it.
Yeah, sub-125.
Right. So when you've got Colin Sexton on your team, then all of the NBA people are coming through and they go, okay, who's this 6'7 dude running and jumping, making shots, you know, getting to the rim? And I know it didn't translate well to the games, but they see the possibilities. So that's how he gets on the radar. So then they go, okay, he's a prospect because he measures a certain way, jumps a certain way, runs a certain way, all this stuff. All right, now go be a player. And he's off to a good start, I think. Production, points per game, basically doubled. Field goal percentage up, 3-point percentage up, and not only up, but good. Mm-hmm. And so now you take that, I think, whatever it is now, 5 or 6 games, and you make it a 12-game sample size, then you make it a 24-game sample size, then you make it a 35-game sample size, and now you're ready to go to the combine and get picked. You know, to be clear, when it comes to mock drafts, I think you can almost always assume the lottery picks are going to be first-round picks. You can always assume the guys who are projected to go in the top 5 are going to go in the lottery, and the guys who are projected in the lottery are going to go in the first round. And then after about 15, 16, 17, it really does become, you know, there's 30 players in play for the next, for the final 15 spots in the first round, maybe 40 players in play. And he's in that group. He's a guy who could be a first round pick, but is not guaranteed to be a first round pick. Whereas, you know, Cam Reddish is guaranteed to be a first round pick. You know, Herb is a guy who can be, but certainly isn't guaranteed to be.
Yeah. Okay, and let me get your thoughts on one more player here at Alabama, a guy who I think will go in the second round based off of the things you talked about, his athleticism, his jumping, his speed. Dante Hall, our power forward slash center, I compare him all the time to a Jordan Bell kind of guy, guys who are going to block shots, get up and down the floor and dunk. And we saw the Warriors were willing to cough up $3.5 million to take him in the second round. Do you think Dante Hall can be that kind of player?
Sure. I mean, in theory, you know, you have to go do it. Jordan Bell was an awesome college player, but he's the type of guy people are looking for now, as opposed to, I don't know, I'll just say a Charles Bassey. Now, I think Charles Bassey at Western Kentucky is still going to be a first-round pick, but he's more of a traditional big. And you know as well as I do, traditional bigs are getting taken off the court in the NBA, and it's trickling down to college basketball. If you watch the Duke-Gonzaga game, you know, Duke's, we talked about the four freshmen. The fifth starter is Marquise Boulding, who is a traditional big. He's exactly what a center is supposed to be. And Gonzaga put him in so many ball screens, he couldn't stay on the court. And that happens all the time in the NBA. I mean, you have to really be special to be a traditional big, you know, if you're going to try to play in the NBA these days. You've got, like, Marc Gasol in Memphis is a traditional big, but he became a traditional big who could step away from the basket so he can play. But if you are just a back-to-the-basket, you know, traditional big, like Jahlil Okafor was coming out of college, it's hard to play. And so the best way to get a job being a big in the modern NBA is to be somebody who can switch ball screens, you know, guards, you know, guard on the perimeter, run, block shots, rim protect, all that kind of stuff. You know, shoot the ball, all that helps. But really, switching ball screens. I mean, if any young big was asking me what is the most important thing that I've got to get great at to be able to have a job at the NBA, can you switch ball screens? Because that's all the NBA – it's not all the NBA is, but it's a lot. The NBA is put people in ball screens, get favorable matchups, then attack them. And if you cannot move your feet, you cannot play. And so, you know, those are the keys. Like, you know, watch him against UCF. Watch him, you know, once the SEC schedule starts to unfold. Can he switch ball screens? Is he active? You know, if those are the types of things he can do, then those are the types of things that will lead him to getting that kind of attention. Absolutely.
Yeah. Thanks for the thoughts on that. Real quick, I know you got other places to be, other people to talk to, but if you don't mind, I'm going to get your thoughts on these new net rankings that have come out. To me, they seem pretty stupid. I really don't like it so far. They say it's going to take a bigger sample size, but any system that ranks Radford with one loss over Kansas, I don't see the point of. What are your thoughts been so far on it?
Well, I'm not going to argue the pros and cons of the algorithm. Because, A, I don't know exactly what it is. Nobody does except the NCAA. And, B, I'm not smart enough to argue algorithms. You know, I'm going to let other people do that. I will say it's not a great sign that Nate Silver, like, does this for a living, runs the 538 blog, and he says it's a terrible algorithm that, yeah, might get better with time as more data is inserted, but it'll never be what it ought to be. I don't know if that's true. I just know he said it, and that can't be a good sign. What I will say is that releasing it on the Monday after Thanksgiving was just really, really dumb. And I Dan Gavitt is the guy in charge of releasing it, and he's a friend of mine. And so I don't mean that Dan Gavitt's dumb. I mean that he made a dumb decision, or he and the other people involved made a dumb decision here. Their argument is that, well, we used to release the official RPI after Thanksgiving, on the Monday after Thanksgiving, so we wanted to stay true to that. Well, the difference here is that nobody needed to see the official RPI. The RPI was a well-known, very basic formula that was replicated all over the internet. CBSSports.com had an RPI page. So on the Monday after Thanksgiving, nobody was like, oh, whoa, look at the RPI. We looked at the RPI yesterday and the day before that, and the day before that. So it didn't have the same kind of shock factor when it when something looked off. You know, this was your brand new thing that's supposed to be better than Zagrin, better than the RPI, better than KenPom. And so everybody is like, okay, let's take a look at it. And then it's got Ohio State 1, Loyola Marymount 10, Kansas outside of the top 10, Kentucky 61. It looks ridiculous. And so by releasing it voluntarily, you were setting yourself up to just be ridiculed, mocked, called stupid. Like, why? My advice to them would have been, hold it. Nobody needs it the Monday after Thanksgiving. Nobody's asking for it. Nobody's demanding it. You're not obligated to publish it. Hold it until it looks sensible. If you are convinced that with time and more data, it'll look the way it's supposed to look, hold it until that day. And I don't care if it's, you know, December 3rd, December 18th, January 4th, January 26th. I don't care when it is. Day after the BCS game, the college football playoff game, championship. Whenever you wake up and you look at your numbers and they look sensible, then release it. That way people go, oh, okay, that looks about right. But to release it looking this way, just a bad mistake. And I know one of their arguments is, hey, but people have been talking about us all week long. We were on First Take. We were on Around the Horn. You know, no publicity is bad publicity. That's not true. Like, Dwight Howard got a lot of publicity last weekend. It wasn't great publicity for Dwight Howard. Bill Cosby got a lot of publicity over the past couple of years. Wasn't great for him. The idea that all attention is good attention is just simply untrue. It's something people say, but it's not true. When the attention you're getting, the publicity you're getting, is people on national television calling you stupid, mocking your formula, that's not good for you. And I don't know why they weren't smart enough to recognize that in advance.
Yeah, definitely a bad look. And my thought process on all of it from the beginning when they announced that they were going to change the rankings, why not just go with a KenPom or this any of the others that have been established that have years of data backing them and that everyone has already accepted as a legitimate way to do things?
Yeah, their argument is that KenPom is a predictive formula and they don't want it to be predictive. They want it to be a direct result of things that have happened in this season with no regard for past seasons, because that's what the selection process is supposed to be. And that's fine. I don't fundamentally disagree with that, but then you got to hold your formula until you've got enough information. You know, one of the reasons KenPom looks good when you look at it today, it looks like the teams that are supposed to be at the top are at the top, is because they use preseason data. But the net, the NCAA's formula, does not, so it looks crazy, you know, sitting here the week after Thanksgiving. If you want to have the algorithm you have that has no preseason data whatsoever, fine with me, I guess, but then you got to keep that private until maybe middle of January, even February 1, because to release it prematurely means you're releasing rankings that make no sense, which leads to people all over the country yelling that your rankings make no sense.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for the insight, Gary. Everybody, this is Gary Parrish from CBS Sports, lead basketball or lead college basketball writer. I'll let you go, but first, why don't you let people know how they can check you out, where they can listen to you more?
Well, obviously, we've got the Eye on College Basketball podcast. That's the CBS Sports College Basketball podcast. That is, I don't say this to brag, but just to put some credibility to it. It's the most listened to college basketball podcast in the country. You can find that anywhere you find that podcast, including Apple Podcasts. I host, obviously, the Gary Parrish Show in Memphis 4 to 6 weekdays on 92.9 FM ESPN. And then I'm on television, CBS Sports Network, video, CBS Sports HQ. I write CBSSports.com. I got a lot of jobs. And on on Twitter, you can find me, Gary Parrish, CBS.
All right. Thanks, Gary. I really appreciate you coming in. Hope to talk to you soon.
All right, buddy. I'll see you. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye. All right. That was Gary Parrish from CBS Sports. I hope you guys enjoyed
that. Was very interesting.
It was. He is a really interesting guy. Of course, he got to go out. He spent his Thanksgiving – in Hawaii.
Oh,
yeah,
that's
at the
dream.
At the Maui,
that's the dream.
The Maui Invitational. He got to see Auburn play. He got to see Duke play, as he talked about.
I really enjoyed that tournament. That was actually very, very, like, I really enjoyed watching that unfold as a whole.
I did, too. We got to see Duke challenged by Auburn and then beat by Gonzaga. Gonzaga now maybe the favorite team. Number one, of course.
I wouldn't say that.
You wouldn't say that. Mm-hmm. You don't believe in that core group of guys, a lot of them upperclassmen even. You got sophomores and juniors on that team. Rui Hachimura, a junior, who could still go in the lottery.
Yeah, I like Hachimura. He was fantastic in that game. He did what he was supposed to, being that big man down low and affecting everything that they were trying to do down there. But honestly, Duke should have won that game, in my opinion. There was a lot of – they gave him a lot of opportunities. Hachimura basically gave it to them at the free throw line, missing those last four shots. And then not only that, but he basically fouled the guy on the last possession.
He did.
But, you know, refs hold the whistle on the last possessions, mm-hmm. let them play it out. Duke should have won that basketball game. If I'm Coach Cal, you know, that's their third ranked top 10 team
right.
that they had to play in like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
That's not a bad loss to me. You only lost by one possession.
And I think it
Duke
gives them
still
even more
control
motivation.
Their destiny.
More motivation going forward when they do play more big teams like that. Look, you got punched in the mouth. Now it's time to come back and win these big matchups.
Honestly, it was probably a blessing in disguise for him. For the team as a whole, because now they don't have to hear the nonsense talking about, you know, hey, you know, are you guys going to go undefeated? Mm-hmm. Are you guys the greatest college basketball team ever? No, they can finally sit down. They're allowed to make mistakes now. They're allowed to be human, and they can go out and just play the game of basketball. And I always say you have to lose in order to win a championship.
Right.
So I was the one loss that they needed. It was a tournament type of style, literally mm-hmm. a Final Four kind of game in a smaller venue, a high school gym.
Yeah, high school gym
but
on Maui.
Anyways, it was a great game. I'm taking that as a win for Duke.
Yeah, and that's what Gary did over Thanksgiving. Now let's talk about what we did over Thanksgiving. I want to get your top five Thanksgiving foods.
Oh, top five Thanksgiving foods. I am always a fan of the turkey.
All right, we got turkey.
I got turkey. Mac and cheese is always up there. I'm always a huge fan. I know this is going to be weird. My mom likes to grill chicken, like mm-hmm. put it on the grill and make some barbecue chicken. I'm always a fan of that.
Hey, barbecue chicken.
We have barbecue chicken. I specifically request the barbecue chicken for Thanksgiving.
All right, never heard that one for Thanksgiving before.
I'm a cornbread guy, and then also we like desserts in my family.
Of course,
naturally.
Gotta have desserts.
So I'm a big fan of cake. My mom makes a nice cake. She makes a good chocolate cake.
A chocolate cake.
So that's usually what's on my plate.
What's on your plate? All right.
What about you, man?
We love desserts also at my house. We make probably four or five pies usually most Thanksgivings. I'm a big fan. I always like to have one slice at least of pumpkin pie. I'm a fan of turkey, not a huge fan. Like, I'm going to eat it because it's the meat portion of the meal.
Yeah.
But my favorite dishes, we have a really good sweet potato casserole recipe that's in our family. We got some, like, crushed up almonds and brown sugar on top of it. Cook it up real nice. I could eat that up all day.
Yeah.
We always have really good mashed potatoes, fresh made from scratch. Other than that, I got to go with my pies.
Got to go with your pies.
We always get this nice Oreo pie.
I'm telling you, man. I'm going to tell you something.
Real good Oreo pie.
Real secret in my family is we have the turkey, but I put barbecue sauce on it. Sweet Baby Ray's barbecue sauce.
You do.
And I make a little sandwich out of it. Delicious. You
should try it. So we use my family. My mom's from up north. So we do stuffing rather than dressing. We'll make my dad some dressing because he's from down south. So we'll usually get him something.
The good man.
Yeah. So we'll make, but me and my mom, we like our stuffing. And so with that stuffing, you get all the juice from the turkey that ends up in the bottom of the pan. We make our own gravy afterwards.
Ooh.
So we get some stuffing, turkey, and then we drizzle our gravy over the top of it. And man, that's good.
Sounds like it
delicious.
Sounds
probably
like
the best part of the meal. Now that we've gotten you guys all hungry out there, let's talk about Alabama and what they did since we last spoke.
I'm hungry for a win from them.
Hungry for a win. We got one since we last spoke, lost one. We got two games coming up before we talk again, but let's go over the ones that happened already. We played Murray State, and I thought that was a great win for us.
A great win.
A game that I said I was worried about, And I think my worries were warranted, seeing that Ja Morant put 38 points on 29 field goal attempts. He really carries that team. That's pretty much what I expected. I didn't think he was going to get that high, obviously. But playing the full 40 minutes did not come out of the game. He had a monster dunk on Dante Hall. Dante made the smart business decision to get out of the way.
That's a common thing now, is making the business decision. Let's not get me on SportsCenter today.
Right. I thought it was interesting. A former Alabama basketball coach, Wimp Sanderson, was calling the game with Eli Gold. And Eli Gold, obviously, he loses it. He's like, wow, what a dunk by Ja Morant.
Yeah.
Everyone's going crazy. The crowd is like, ooh. When you see an away crowd react that way to a dunk, you know it was real.
Yeah.
Wimp Sanderson's reaction, though, I was shocked.
That's Alabama.
I was shocked.
That's
I was
Alabama
shocked by
him.
It. I did not. I was like, come on, Wimp. You know,
that's
I,
Alabama.
That was a big, big time dunk.
It's like whenever we see, like, you know, Auburn do something good, we're just like, you know, good for you. You still lose against us. It's all right. You know, it's okay. But I think the story of that game, John Petty, 0-for-4 from 3-point range, and Dante Hall with only 2 points the entire game. 6 rebounds.
Right. No made field goals.
3
though.
Blocks. He contributed in different areas, but only 2 points. And surprisingly, those 2 points came from the free throw line, making 2-for-2, which is a shock to me. Mm-hmm. But it's just, what's going on with Dante, man?
It's the inconsistency in the usage in the offense that really confuses me. One night we see him being the focal point, and he's up at the high post, he's down on the low post, he's doing everything for this team, he's setting picks, he's rolling to the basket. And then the next night it seems like he's just kind of stationary. And I think you need to get him involved early, because when you don't get him involved early, he kind of sits back, he kind of relaxes.
Gets lackadaisical.
Yeah, he kind of gets lazy on the offensive end. And, of course, we're going to get these 3-block games, 6 rebounds. A little low for him, but in a college game, that's about
– That's a good number.
Yeah. So I'm not worried about the rebounding stats or the blocks. Even the steals, he had one of those in the Murray State game. But what worries me is the offensive usage rate. And he just doesn't seem to get involved every game, and I don't know if that's by a strategy that they're using, which I don't see what merit there could be in that kind of strategy. But I really want to see him get involved early, whether it's on the ball and scoring, or whether it's just setting those screens and rolling to the basket, creating space for other players. I think we need to get him more involved earlier in the offense.
I definitely agree with that. Kyra Lewis also having great day.
The positive storyline in this game, yes, other than the win.
Yes, Kyra Lewis 7-for-10 from the free throw line. He only made 1 3-pointer, but, you know, that's okay. You score 20 points, you can do whatever you want. And also, my interesting thing is him and Herb Jones, only people able to put stats in every box, in rebounds, assists, steals, blocks, you know, making everything count. Herb Jones only with 7 points, though, but came back with 8 rebounds and 4 assists. Whose outing was more impressive to you, Kyra's or what's his name, Ja Morant? Let me ask you that.
I'm gonna have to go with Morant. I know Morant. He didn't get a win against us, but 38 points. He was really carrying that team. Like I said, he took 29 shots. Some people call that ball hogging. Some people will say that he needs to pass more. He still had 5 assists.
It's only ball,
he had 9
it's
rebounds.
Only ball hogging if you get blown out.
Right. It's only ball hogging if you're the reason that they lose, and that he
was
certainly
not.
Was not. Yeah. He did turn the ball over 10 times, but when you're having nearly 100% usage rate, I mean
you're
going to
turn the ball over.
That's a lot, but I think that speaks to what Kyra did. Forcing steals and really just making his night harder than it had to be. And I think he could have gone for even more if we didn't have Kyra Lewis out there being the primary guy guarding him throughout the game.
Most definitely.
Let's talk a little bit now about the next game. It was a loss. UCF, the national championship game.
Of all teams to lose to, that
was
hurt me the most.
Not a good night for the Crimson Tide, losing 70-64. Alex Reese led the team in scoring with 14 points. B.J. Taylor led both teams, the guard from UCF, with 24. shooting 6 of 11 from the field, 9 of 11 from the free throw line.
He hurt us. And Dawkins as well, going 10 for 10 from the free throw line.
It's hard. You can look at this two different sides, and I think it combines. On one hand, you look at the rebounding stats, and everyone says whoever wins the rebounding battle usually wins a game. Alabama won that 46-29, a huge margin on the boards.
That's what kept them in the game. Taco Fall
played only 19 minutes. I thought that I told you I didn't think he was that big of a factor for this UCF team. He's just big. He's just out there. But he's definitely a factor while he is out there in the rebounding game, and we were still able to out-rebound them by 17 rebounds.
I think Taco Falls looked very overrated in this game. He only got 4 blocks and 2 rebounds.
Only 4 blocks.
Only 4 blocks. You're 7'6", and 2 of them were against Dante Hall at one point.
Yeah.
So, like, he really only got about 3 blocks and 2 rebounds at 7'6", and he barely inched away 10 points. He basically scoreless heading into halftime, and then he lit it up again, like, late in the fourth, like, after we almost threw in the towel.
Yeah.
You're 7'6", man. You're 7'6". You're a senior. This is your fourth year.
All right. And that's why he's
college
not in
basketball,
the NBA.
And you're playing only 19 minutes, and you only get 2 rebounds, and you're 7'6". That's absolutely ludicrous. That's ridiculous.
Right.
To my head. That just reminds me of what was it? Jimmy Taylor a couple of years ago. The guy was 7'6", 11", had a wingspan like crazy, but he was too scared to go up and get rebounds for us. And it's like, it frustrates me. How can you be so tall and have arms so long and not want to get rebounds? You should be out there with
a
motor.
At the least, you should be able to do that.
Yeah, you should at least, like, you only got 2. You should at least, at 7'6", be able to tip in 3 baskets.
Right.
Like, it's ridiculous. They just have to just toss it up as high as they can. You're basically a foot taller than Dante Hall. No one's going to get that from you, man.
No.
You got to be able to do better than that.
Yeah. So that's the side that we look at and we think Alabama has the advantage. How are they going to lose this? But then you look at the field goal percentage, and we lost the field goal shooting percentage battle by 9%, and it's hard to win a game shooting 9% from the field lower than the other team also.
And also, I'll tell you one thing as well. We were shooting from the three-point line. We shot 24 times, only made 5, while they shot it 15 times and made 5.
And that's something I talked about. We talked about with Gary, I think, was UCF. We shot the ball a lot more than they did, and it's just not going in. We need to shoot the ball more efficiently.
Yes.
And if I don't care if we shoot that many threes. Actually, I'm sorry, I did not talk about that with Gary. I talked about that on 100.9, 102.9, The Tide.
Yeah.
On Friday, we talked about how Alabama shot the ball too much for what their percentage was. It's not too many threes to shoot in a game. It's actually kind of low in the national rankings in terms of how many we take per game. But
It's
the quality of the shot. It's these end of shot clock threes that we're just kind of taking because what else are we going to do? The shot clock is running down.
Yeah.
We need, in this game against UCF, you look, we lost by 6. We took 9 more threes than they did, made the same number. We take those 9 shots that were not
make
good
them
shots.
Feasible twos.
We turn them into driving, and you just try to draw a foul. You can get 6 points out of that easy.
Most definitely. And again, like you said, driving to the paint. That's basically what UCF did, and it worked. Mm-hmm. They got to the free throw line 36 times. They had a worse free throw percentage than us, but they went there more. And they got basically 14 extra points out of that. Like, come on, guys. Come on, guys. Just, you guys are good enough. You guys were more athletic than they were. You guys should be able to drive to the paint and get those fouls, especially with big old Taco Falls down there. He was in foul trouble basically the entire game.
Yeah.
You should exploit that. He can't move that well. He's basically a sitting
right,
foul.
Right, and that's what I asked them to do, really, in this game, was take Kyra Lewis, take Dante Hall, take Herb Jones, and just run up and down as fast as you can. and don't look back. Because Taco Fall can't run up and down the court the way Dante Hall can.
No.
And so you get up in transition and have Dante running up and down, and this game completely shifts. And I think we did a little bit of that. Dante had a better day than he did against Murray State.
Most definitely.
He had 11 points, had 2 blocks, 9 rebounds. It was a good day for him, but I don't think it was enough against the competition that he had. Against a guy who's a lot bigger than him, a lot stronger than him, really, he needed to be running more up and down and getting the ball to him as quick as we can. Don't let Taco Fall set up. Like you said, he blocked 2 shots on one possession. That shouldn't happen if we just get the ball to Dante in transition running up the floor.
And even then, that wasn't even necessary because you do one pump fake, he's in the air, mm-hmm. boom, there's your foul.
Right there,
he doesn't even need to get those 2 blocks.
I think Dante can get to the free throw line a little more definitely. Only two. I think he gets to the line basically once a game shooting 2 free throws.
The free throw thing is what's killing me. And like last year was that we weren't making enough.
Yeah.
This year we're not even trying to get there.
Yeah.
I feel like we've gotten a little.
And I think
scared
that's something that was the Colin Sexton effect. Was Colin was going to run in there and draw the foul no matter what happened around him.
Kyra was a little bit more timid about it. Saying, I'm 17. Mm-hmm. Still got a lot of years.
He had
left
no
on my legs.
Free throw attempts in this last game against UCF. I think that definitely was a factor and could have hurt us because he's one of the best free throw shooters on this team. Obviously, we allow him to be the one being fouled at the end of games when we are up and teams are fouling us, trying to get back into things.
Let the national champions have some bragging rights. that game hurt. That game hurt to watch.
It did, especially back-to-back years. First they came in here and got us last year. We thought this year we could get back.
Yeah. And then not only that, but the thing that really killed me, 1 for 7, John Petty.
Yeah, shooting has not been good.
And that 1-3 came at the very end when it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. So he really was 0 for 6.
Yeah.
That one hurt. You got to be able to shoot John Petty outside of Coleman. That's why you didn't go to the draft last year. You have everything else capable to make it into the league as a great player. You could be the next Kyle Korver, the next Klay Thompson. He has that ability. He can play defense when he so chooses. He can work well off of ball screens. Mm-hmm. But the guy just can't shoot away from home, man.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to look at why that might be. What might lead
maybe
into that?
Maybe he gets the yips or something.
Maybe that's
know.
It. I have trouble really putting that together. I know it's not an easy thing to do, go on the road, all those fans screaming at you, true road game. But even we see on neutral courts in the Charleston Classic, he didn't shoot well.
Yeah.
It's just been a weird thing to watch unfold. Coming up, though, we've got Georgia State. We'll be at that game covering it. Georgia State really should be a walkthrough. They're not the Georgia State that had R.J. Hunter and his dad a few years ago when we saw them make their tournament run, their Cinderella story. It's not the father-son team anymore. This is a 5-3 mid-major that Alabama should handle on their way.
Those are
the
ones
weekend.
We always lose to, though, is the ones we should handle, mid-majors, you know, that have a little bit of tournament success. Those are the ones that we always just happen to lose to, and I just don't understand it.
And I think that's why this one's really important, because we need to build confidence going into the weekend with another big game that will be broadcast on ESPN.
Arizona,
big matchup Sunday.
Justin Coleman making his return to Coleman Coliseum. Yes, I'm very excited for that game.
I'm excited for it. I think it's a good home and away that we set up here. Avery Johnson got done. UA versus UA. You've got Arizona and Alabama. 6-2, the Arizona Wildcats. 5-2, the Alabama Crimson Tide. Alabama favored pretty heavily in this game. The matchup predictor.
I don't think we should be.
The matchup predictor on ESPN gives us an 81% chance to win. You say you don't think we should be favored. Why is that?
Again, like I said, there's one person that everybody's forgetting about this entire thing, and his name is Justin Coleman. The guy has played for Avery Johnson for a year here in Coleman Coliseum. He's going to let those guys know what type of atmosphere they're about to walk into. He's going to let those guys know, like, hey, this is something different. Alabama SEC fans are crazy. They are weird. They are they are rowdy. They will get personal with you. If your mom has a weird last name, they will make sure to exploit it the entire game. If your hair looks weird, you have a bad hairline, they will make sure to get wave cutouts to make it show like your hairline.
The last noon game that we had here in Coleman on ESPN was that Trae Young matchup on against
Oklahoma.
And
we had birds. We had people dressed up as birds because Trae Young was scared of birds.
Scared of birds.
Where they found that information out, I still have no clue. But it was like the atmosphere is crazy when we have big-time opponents here. Mm-hmm. We go deep. We go in detail. And we make sure that we do whatever we can to give our home team the advantage. And Kyra Lewis, great player. But I think Herb Jones is going to have to be the factor in that game.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to have to be able to show out. He's going to have to be able to guard the 1-4 position. And he's definitely going to have to guard Justin Coleman. Justin Coleman is coming into his own as a point guard right now.
See, this is a game I like Alabama's odds in this one because the Arizona Wildcats have come in. They're kind of a down team. This is a down year for them, certainly, versus where they usually are, which is a top 25, usually a top 10, top 15 program. Having a down year after all the investigations last year, all the controversy, had a couple guys decommit and go elsewhere. But you've still got Chase Jeter, you've still got Randolph, you've still got Coleman, as you said. And I think that they're a team that you have to take serious. But I think it was a great job by the athletic department, Greg Byrne, Avery Johnson, to get this home and away set up.
Yes.
Last year, Arizona, DeAndre Ayton's on the team. They're what they usually are, which is a top program.
DeAndre Ayton
and it was a good time for Alabama to go on a true road game and find out what they were made of before conference play.
Yes.
And I think it built a lot of character on this team. That game came down to the wire, even though we ended up losing. It still was a big time deal for this team meshing and really creating what they needed to get to the NCAA tournament at the end of the year. And so I think this year, what we see is a down year for Arizona. Alabama without Colin Sexton, it's another good gauge of where we are going into SEC play.
Yes.
And so it's worked out really well for both schools, this home and away. I like matchups like this. True home and aways in basketball you don't see often, unless it's a mid-major. And so I really like that the Pac-12 and SEC were able to get this done. I think there should be more like it. Obviously, we see like the Big 12 SEC challenge. We see stuff like that.
Big 10,
but that's kind of randomly assigned, like that.
Big 10 ACC.
I like when two teams say, hey, we want to play you, and then you play us, and then we will be able to gauge where our teams are.
Yeah.
At that point. And I think it's perfectly placed in the schedule. You have time to recover from it if it goes poorly, and you have time to build off of it if it goes well.
Yeah. And also, Arizona's only two losses this year are to Gonzaga and Auburn, two very good basketball teams. So this is going to be a great gauge for them because their last outing against basically D1 competition didn't go well. So they're definitely going to be coming in hungry coming against us, whereas we still are trying to look for our first win versus D1 level competition, in my opinion, like top power five level competition.
I think we're still looking for our identity on this team too.
Like
the offensive identity.
Do
I think
we
want to
shoot or do
we
want to use Dante Hall?
Right, mm-hmm. And it fluctuates game back and forth, game to game. You'll see. And it doesn't go well when you don't know what identity you're going with from game to game. They need to come out, establish what do we want to do, what is the focal point of our offense, and where is the ball going to run through. And I know Kyra Lewis has done an excellent job as the point guard of setting up the offense and getting into things. But I think from there, it's been a little bit chaotic. There's not a lot of confidence of who's going to be where, when things are going to happen on the offensive end of the floor like there is on the defensive end.
Yep.
On the defensive end, you know Herb Jones is going to lock his guy down. Kyra Lewis is going to give it everything he's got. Dante Hall has the middle locked down.
Defense is never
John
our
Petty
problem.
Can guard a wing. And then you've got whoever the other guy in there is.
Maybe Alex Reese. Maybe Daniel Giddens.
And is going to be able to help
Galen Smith.
Help and pull out on the guy, the stretch fours, or they can stay down low if they need to and guard them.
Especially Alex Reese. He's definitely come into his own this year.
Right, he has. He's been a pleasant surprise for this team. Coming out, he's shooting better than he did last year, shooting with more volume, and he's really been more of a force while he's on the floor. More passive guy last year, a guy who was going to find himself with the ball, now calling for the ball and getting it.
Yeah. So this is going to be a very interesting stretch here as we move into the new year, the month of December, because we're going to have a win, or I should say we're going to have mid-major, power five, mid-major, power five, mid-major.
Right, but that last mid-major is a big one.
Yeah, this is a big one, and it's going to, and then right after that, and that one's on the road against, was this,
Stephen F. Austin.
Stephen F. Austin, yep. Excuse me, down there in Texas. And then after that, we have to come home to Kentucky.
Yeah.
First SEC game is Kentucky on January 5th. So we have to have some momentum, especially after that UCF loss. We have to have some momentum coming in from that series right here. I feel like if we get a nice win against Arizona, Penn State, and SFA.
And you've got Liberty will be a big momentum builder too, because that's the Rocket City Classic. That's a neutral site game. Even though that's a smaller team,
yeah,
you can't knock the confidence that it gives you to win in a neutral floor,
John Petty will light that up.
Right, and everyone there is going to be big Alabama supporters, so it's a neutral site game where you are really the home team.
And Petty, I think that's, I don't know what it is about Huntsville, but John Petty just shoots well in Huntsville. That's the only away.
I mean,
place.
that is where he came from. That's where he, that is his home gym.
Yeah, so you know that's like. Outside of Coleman, that's the best place that he shoots at.
Yeah, that
is right
the,
there.
The next best thing
so,
that yeah. we've got. We've got coming up on SEC play. Right now, you look at the rankings. A lot has happened since we last spoke. Vanderbilt's star guard, Darius Garland, has gone down with a meniscus injury. He's expected to be out for the year.
That's
and Vanderbilt, a team that I was really high on, I said, let's wait and see what they can do. Unfortunately, it now looks like we're not going to be able to see them at their full potential. Darius Garland, a guy who, despite this injury, can still go in the lottery from a lot of what I've heard. A guy who, that's how...
I mean, it's not uncommon for a player to go down an injury in college basketball. Actually, I think it kind of helps a little bit because you save your miles and you save your minutes.
Mm-hmm.
To do it in college basketball, you get the rehab program, you get straight.
Right, and meniscus is an injury where it's not necessarily one like an ACL or an MCL where it's something that you worry a lot about moving forward. Meniscus is obviously a bad injury, something you don't want,
but it's
not as
something
critical
that's not,
of a element of your knee.
Yeah,
structure.
It's not something that is going to like be something that teams are going to worry about it
right, moving forward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Every so often. So it's a good injury to I'm not saying that any injury is good, but if there was an injury to have at the time that
especially
is
in the knee, that's the one you would want if you had to choose one.
So just get better, young fellow, just work, and it gives you an opportunity to really work back on your fundamentals.
Right.
Which is gonna be basically what the NBA draft is all about. So
Darius Garland, a guy who really unfortunate for Vanderbilt. They were looking really good and he was a guy who was running the offense. He was able to score. He can really do a lot from that point guard position. And a local kid, too, from the city of Nashville. And so really unfortunate we had that. We also had big news on the recruiting front. Right as I was heading home, actually, I had to stop, find a TV. And
get some Wi-Fi.
And stop, yeah, at noon.
James
to
Wiseman.
Hear the commitment of James Wiseman. To the University of Memphis, he has since signed all of his official papers. It's a done deal now. He will join Penny Hardaway in the city of Memphis for 1 year of basketball before going to the NBA, which is inevitable. A lot of people watched that and they asked me, they said, what is this unicorn about? Why is he pulling out a stuffed unicorn on the counter of his
commitment? He got the Kristaps Porzingis.
He's got that. So for those of you who don't know, he's a part of the Unicorn Gang. It's a group of guys who consider themselves to be unique basketball players, guys who we haven't seen anything like them, seven-footers around there at least, who can handle the ball like guards. They can shoot the ball. They can do all these things that you've never seen done before.
Kevin Durant's butt in college.
Right. And so it's this group of guys who they're in high school right now. They call themselves the Unicorns, and they want to go out and prove to people that guard things can be done by big men too. And so James Wiseman, definitely a guy who can do that. He's a big guy, 7 foot tall, 7'6", 7'5", wingspan, yeah, I'd say that. Right now. He can still grow, though, obviously, as a senior in high school. And, you know, he's got limitless potential for what he can be. But what we talked about before with this James Wiseman commitment coming up was that it had at least some sort of an impact on the recruitment of Trendon Watford.
Yep.
And so what we've seen now is he has gone to Memphis, not Kentucky. So fans no longer have to choose, you know, do you want the number one recruit at Kentucky so that you get the number 25 recruit or whatever it might, the ending rankings might be.
Yeah.
But I know that was a kind of a fun way to look at it. But really, the odds of getting Trendon Watford realistically have gone down. I don't think there is zero by any means. We still are in there. We're still recruiting him hard, but it's more important than ever to really lock him down and really get in his mind that this is where he should be now.
Oh, right now, I'm looking on ESPN.com, and I'm looking at his school list. Right now, he has four schools. It's Alabama, Auburn, Mississippi State, and UCF, of all places. So I feel like we have a good chance. Auburn, I feel like he'll be worried about necessarily the NFL, the NBA aspect of it, because Auburn players outside of Charles Barkley don't usually do that well in the NBA. Avery Johnson, again, a proven guy in the NBA, both as a player and a coach, making sure he's going to be he's very Calipari-ish in his approach of, look, you come to my team, I'm going to get you ready for the NBA. I don't necessarily care about the college aspect of it because, you know, you're just going to come here, play some games, and you're going to go about your way.
Right.
But I'm going to make sure that when you go to the draft, you're ready, you're prepared, and you get picked.
I do think one of the things that has the biggest impact on Trendon Watford's decision is, does Trendon believe that he is a one-and-done player? He's a guy who's kind of on that border of whether or not he will be.
It all depends on the coach that he gets.
Right, and that's what I'm going with is does he want to go to Memphis where he can go with James Wiseman and maybe raise his stock more in 1 year and possibly get to where he can be drafted in the mid to late 20s, maybe even up into the teens? A guy who Penny Hardaway, that's kind of his sales pitch is, hey, we'll get you to the NBA quick. Or does he want to come to Alabama where maybe he stays another year, plays his sophomore season with us, but maybe that elevates his game even more to like a Rui Hachimura kind of guy who he stayed a little longer, but he got even better.
To me, if I were to play basketball, I would want to stay multiple years in college. Most one-and-dones don't usually pan out that well in the NBA because they don't get the correct amount of experience. There are, again, special cases like Joel Embiid's, Kyrie Irving's.
But like we talked with Joel, he even had that extra year to sit out and to really show him the ropes.
And then even still, Kyrie Irving still had that year to sit out. But people who actually play the game of basketball that first year, almost all the way through, declare for the draft, usually
it's a high percentage of guys who aren't ready for
that stage.
Aren't
ready for it. So
at least at that time. Some revitalize their careers later on. But very few guys are ready right after 1 year of college.
Yes. So usually it takes about 2 to 3 years if you really want to just make sure, stay for four, get your education. And it's not necessarily about the education aspect of getting your degree, going to the NBA. I mean, that's part of it because, number one, most NBA players don't know how to handle their money. College is a great place to learn how to handle your money.
Yeah.
Especially coming in as a rookie.
Classes where that's all they do.
Yes.
Teach you how to do that.
Handle your money. So that's one aspect of it where you can learn from it. Number two, you get the full college experience. You're allowed to grow and you're allowed to develop your body. That's the main reason why these one and dones don't do well in the NBA is because they haven't allowed time for their bodies to develop, their minds to develop the game of basketball at such an elite level to where they can compete in the NBA. And usually by the time they get to that point, they're already dubbed as a bust, and they usually don't come back from that. I mean, look at a guy like Alex Lynn, who came out first year. Was he 18 that he came into the NBA?
He was very young. I think 19 maybe.
19. Right now he's 22, already considered a bust. But his body is probably just now developing into that NBA body.
Mm-hmm.
But he just wasn't ready to come into the NBA yet, you know? Yeah. Lonzo Ball is one of the exceptions to the rules, I would assume, just because –
One of the exceptions, and really this whole draft class from this last season appears to be an exception. You've got Jaren Jackson. Is from this last draft class. Jaren Jackson, you've got DeAndre Ayton. He's not playing incredible right now, but he's giving you double-doubles most nights.
Yeah.
And you've got guys, Luka Doncic is a different story. He's been a professional almost his whole life.
Luka
Doncic
is
a whole other
category
than what anyone has ever been before. Even these other European players you see, they came into the league as prospects. Luka came in as a player. He was ready for the NBA.
That kid can ball.
He can play.
That kid can ball.
Shooting pull-up 39-footers.
They got Dennis Smith Jr., Luka Doncic.
Yeah, I think the future is bright in Dallas.
Yeah, they just need one more big man down there to match with DeAndre Jordan. Watch out the West. They're coming.
Yep. And then one more note on Trendon Watford before we move on to our next topic is Alabama has him in here for a visit January 4th, the day before the Kentucky game. Another team who he's got a visit coming up with, LSU, November 2nd. They are a hot riser on his list. A lot of people say Will Wade has been in there recruiting him hard. And so really what I have heard is that it's down to Alabama, Memphis, LSU. And then you can't count out Indiana, I don't think, because they have his brother obviously played there. He's familiar with the program.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think that's kind of like a fallback option for him in the end if he doesn't like
anybody else.
Right. And so what else do you see moving forward? Is it whether it's this season or the future with recruiting that we need for this Alabama team? What is the missing piece for this team to get back up into that top 25 discussion and into the tournament discussion?
To me, it's the culture of Bama basketball. I feel like we are moving in the right direction. Because, what was it, the first 2 years Avery Johnson was here, NIT first-round exit. The guys just weren't mentally tough.
Yeah.
Because they would go into games and they would just say, oh, we got this, and then lose. Mm-hmm. And then in games where they just feel like they didn't have it, they would magically pull it out and win. So it's mentally getting them tough and understanding, like, just because you're favored to win doesn't mean you play at
the level of your competition. Play at your level.
Play at your level. Once they understand that and they transition in that, which I think we got a great group of guys who do that. Herb Jones, Dante Hall is one of those people.
Right.
Honestly, Dazon Ingram is also one of those guys as well.
I think Kyra definitely could become one of those guys from what we've seen from him so far.
Yes, who just don't worry about what the other team's doing. Just play at
what you do.
And once we establish that, and again, I think it's going to be two more recruiting classes, honestly, until we get into that top 25 conversation, just people who have been around Avery's guys and who have established as Avery guys, even like people who may have been recruited by the last head coach, but came in under the Avery Johnson regime. Once those guys are gone and they've instilled their wisdom of the Avery Johnson way down all through the ranks. Like Lawson Schaefer is probably your best recruiter. I'm just going to be honest with you because he's had a guard against the best talent that we've had here.
Yeah. And do you think Lawson Schaefer is a guy who they might bring on as a grad assistant then?
I honestly,
as a recruiting kind of guy, a guy who gets in there and tells players, here's what's going to happen. Here's what you need to expect.
If that's what Lawson wants to do, I feel like Avery might be actually kind of open to that idea. Because I don't think there's anyone better to promote your program than a player who's been in your program.
Right, who's been in there and
the
he
fans
worked
love
to get there too.
And not only that, he's guard Colin Sexton.
Mm-hmm.
He's guard Dazon. He's guard Avery Johnson Jr. He can tell you all three tiers, basically, of talent that you're going to be going against and say, like, look, I've guarded against the best. I've guarded against the worst, you know? I may not have been the best player, but dang it, we went out there and we gave 110% effort every single time we were out on the floor. And that's what he's going to expect of you.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I'm the little scrawny little guy.
Yeah.
I'm the bottom of the bench, but you still give 110% every single time you're out there on the floor.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. I agree with all of that you said. We're out of time here today, folks. Hope you tune in next week for our last edition before the winter break. We'll have all kinds of previews for what's up, what's to come, what we've seen so far, and maybe a couple special treats for you guys that you will update
it's
you on
be
later.
Fun.
It will be fun. Thank you for joining us today. This is the No Noise Podcast. My name is James Fletcher.
And I'm Trevin, and we'll see you guys later.